Cheers audition came up, and an agent that I knew sent me in there, and I failed miserably. I had no idea. That's the first time I had ever auditioned.
In what way did you fail? I mean, did you have the lines down? You got nervous? You didn't understand the character? What was the character you auditioned for, and how did you fail as you define it?
I had no idea what they were doing. They hand you the sides,
right?
Which is a few pages of the dialogue. I thought it was just to read while you're sitting there waiting. And so I didn't memorize anything. I said, oh, it's not nice they gave me this. But literally, I had never been through this process before. So I was walking out the door knowing I failed because of the stink that I left in the room. But as I was walking out the door, I just turned and said, do you have a Bardot at all? And one of them said, what are you talking about? So then that's all I needed. I think I picked up a big pen off his desk, and I went into this litany of how the big pen came about. I just really wanted them to know I was in the room, because I'd already spent 10 years making audiences laugh that didn't even, non-English speaking audiences. But I just wanted them to know that I was in the room, and I wanted to leave them a good impression. So I did a couple of minutes on the big pen and left.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. Before we get to my guest this week, a couple of things. I'm on tour with Permission to Speak, my Broadway show. We're taking it all over. We're going to be in Schaumburg, Illinois, end of August, August 23rd, August 24th, Indianapolis. We're going to be in Milwaukee, Wisconsin at the Marcus Center, United Theater in Westerly, Rhode Island. We're going all over the country. Please go to paulmercurio.com for tickets. July 12th, I'm going to be doing stand-up at the Kennedy Center, which is a big honor, and I had no idea why they would want me, but why not? So if you're in the D.C. area, July 12th, Kennedy Center, stand-up. But go to my website, paulmercurio.com. You can see where I'm going to be touring all over the country. I'd love you guys to come see me on the road. By the way, that quote you just heard was from John Ratzenberger, who is my guest this week and is got a great story, which you heard part of how he got the Cliff Clavin character on Cheers. He actually created it in the moment in an audition room in Los Angeles as a result of him having 10 years of experience as an improvisational performer. It's a really great story and a really great interview with John. So I think you're going to enjoy that. So enjoy, John. PaulMercurio.com for tickets. One other quick thing on a personal note. I always laughed at the fact that some socks, and maybe Bombas or whatever, they put the L and the R, one's left and one's right. And I'm like, they look exactly the same. And I made fun of it. But then I realized I'm so anal that I'm actually paying attention to it. And I had my right sock on my left foot and I was in a hurry and I still just changed it and put it on the right foot. So I don't know who the bigger fool is, the industry for putting L and R on socks or me for paying attention to it. But there you go. All right. Enjoy John Ratzenberger. PaulMercurio.com for tickets to my shows on the road. And I'd love to see you guys out there and we'll hang out and enjoy John. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. My guest this week is best known for playing Cliff Clavin on the comedy series Cheers. He's won two Primetime Emmy nominations for his work on that. He's been in almost every Pixar film known to man, including Toy Story, Wall-E, The Incredibles, Inside Out. He's acted in such movies as Superman, Star Wars Episode 5, The Empire Strikes Back, currently starring as a voice of Fritz in Inside Out 2. It's John Ratzenberger. How's it going, John?
Hey, good. Thank you, Paul. Where are you?
I'm in New York City, but I noticed you grew up in Connecticut in Bridgeport, and I've got a place like about an hour north of Bridgeport, so I know that area well. So we have that in common a little bit.
You don't drive through Bridgeport at night, do you?
No. When I do, I tell them I know you, and then they leave me alone. So
basically, that might help. You never know.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But I enjoyed my growing up there because it was a factory town, and everybody knew how to use tools.
Yeah.
They know how to fix things, build things, invent things. So it was a lot of fun growing up there.
Yeah. And did you, I know you're a sailor, did you like, did you get into sailing when you were a kid up there? Because you're not far from the water and all.
Oh, yeah. I had a boat before I had a bicycle.
Oh, yeah.
I think an old rowboat washed up on shore after a hurricane, and me and some buddies, we rolled it into my backyard, you know, using metal pipes to row it on, like the Egyptians and the big blocks of stone. And we fixed it up, you know, fucked it. We placed some floorboards, and I mean, it leaked like a sieve, but nonetheless, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah. We got a little wooden powerboat, you know, like a 20 horse on it for my son when he was like 11 or 12. And now we have like a little 14-foot Boston whaler. And it's the best thing, you know, just tool around and fish a little bit and nothing like being out on the water. It's pretty awesome.
Well, also, as a kid, powering a boat like that, it gives an enormous amount of confidence that most kids don't get. Because if you teach your son or daughter how to use tools and how machines work and, you know, and how, you know, how to operate them, you're doing them a big favor.
Absolutely. And I want to talk about that in your foundation, Nuts, Bolts, and Thingamajigs in a minute, because I grew up loving to work with my hands. But I want to talk about your background a little bit, and you know, you started in London in the 70s. You formed an improvisational duo, Sal's Meat Market. You toured around to standing room only crowds in Europe, like 634 straight performances, I read. How did you end up going from Bridgeport to London, and why London? Were you acting or doing improv here in the U.S. And
the guy that I can blame it on is Ray Hassett. We went to college together and had a lot of fun there. And I actually, after college, migrated up to North Vermont. I was, you know, building houses and banging things together there. And he went off to London as he was a social worker. And after a year or two, maybe, I got a postcard from him saying, oh, you ought to come over here. And so I thought I'd go over for a visit. And I did. I was intended on staying a week, but I stayed 10 years. And Ray and I toured Europe doing a two-man show. We literally would get on stage not knowing what we were going to do, and we'd be up there for an hour and a half.
So that's true improv as opposed to these improv games that get set up that have a structure and then are filled in by audience suggestions, right? This is like you're just truly winging it.
Oh yeah, we went out there at the end of the limb, but we—I don't even know if we knew what improvisation was, because we called it making stuff up. this is before and. Being in Europe there, we didn't even know that there are such things as Second City and improv groups starting to pop up all over. But they would do short sketches, but we would do a full play that we made up that night.
Oh, it was like an actual play with characters that you created and sort of interactions and all that? Wow.
We would do almost a 10 to a dozen characters a piece throughout whatever show it was. And back of the curtain, we would have different props and costumes and hats and coats. And at some point, we didn't even know at what point it was. One of us would just go off stage and grab something back there. And all of a sudden, we're another character that we have to somehow meld into the body of the show.
That's great.
We did. And the audience and the critics found out about it. So there was a lot of repeat audiences because the show changed. Got to be 80-85% every night.
And how were you getting these going from gig to gig? Just word of mouth? Were you guys booking yourself, calling ahead kind of thing?
Well, the the Brits are a little bit more advanced than we are over here. They have the British Arts Council. They have their own circuit, and we hooked up with them, and we got on their tour all through Europe. So we were doing shows in Amsterdam, Rotterdam, you name it. We were there.
So how did that, when you got back to the States and you ended up in LA and you're auditioning and acting and you started getting film work, TV work, how did that improv experience help you? And did it help you in particular in auditions?
Well, I'd never gone to acting school, so I didn't know how to audition.
Mm-hmm.
Ray and I, you know, we did our own shows, South Reed Market over in Europe. And so it was just the two of us. There was no auditioning involved.
Mm.
So when I got to Los Angeles, I was actually asked to write a comedy for CBS. So I flew out there, and at the end of that job, the Cheers audition came up, and an agent that I knew sent me in there, and I failed miserably. I had no idea. That was the first time I had ever auditioned.
In what way did you fail? I mean, did you have the lines down? You got nervous? You didn't understand the character? What was the character you auditioned for, and how did you fail as you define it?
I had no idea what they were doing. They hand you the sides.
Right.
You know, which is a few pages of the dialogue. I thought it was just to read while you're sitting there waiting. And so I didn't memorize anything. I said, oh, well, isn't that nice? They, you know, gave me this for. But literally, I had never been through this process before. So I was walking out the door knowing I failed because the stink that I left in the room. But as I was walking out the door, I just turned and said, do you have a bar no at all? And one of them said, what are you talking about? So then, that's all I needed. I think I picked up it was a Bic pen off his desk, and I went into this litany of how the Bic pen came about. I just really wanted them to know I was in the room, because I'd already spent 10 years making audiences laugh that didn't even, non-English speaking audiences. But I just wanted them to know that I was in the room, and I wanted to leave them a good impression. So I did film a couple of minutes on the big pen and left, and got a call a couple of days later saying they'd like to try this know-it-all character out for, you know, 7 episodes. And so 11 years later, I was still there.
Wow. That is such a great story. It's like so instructive in so many ways, because as you know, for people listening, they're not in this business that we are in. When you audition, you're auditioning for producers and directors in the room and casting people. Those casting people are seeing 20, 30 people all day. They want nothing more to find someone to fill the role. And if they could find somebody like you that surprises them and brings something to the table they didn't think of, that's gold. Like, and it's amazing. It's such a great story, because all of that work that you did for 10 years paid off in that moment. If you had not had that improv experience, you wouldn't have gotten. So it sounds like you wouldn't have been on that show. It's amazing.
Yeah, I think you're right. Also, it's important for when you go on to these auditions, don't get in your own way.
Yes.
You know, all those fears. Oh, you know, maybe if I had known the pedigree of the people sitting in that room judging me, maybe I would have gotten nervous. But I did. And when I just turned around and said, do you have a bar know-it-all? And I explained to them, every bar in New England, where I grew up, has a bar know-it-all that professes to know everything there is to know about anything. And I know in my neighborhood, there was a place where my dad used to hang out. And there was one guy at the end of the bar named Sarge. And he would be the judge of any argument. You know, some guys say, hey, Sarge, what's the length of a whale's intestine? And he'd look up and say, baleen or blue? You know, and I just had a laugh. You know, he's making it up.
Yeah, it's the best. So I read that the Cliff Clavin character wore white socks as a tribute to French comedian Jacques Tati. Is that true?
Yes.
And explain to people who that is and why White Sox and why you wanted to pay an homage to him.
Well, to me, comedy is always played. It's the stuff that goes on between the words. And Jacques Tati was a master at that. And Stan Laurel is another one, a master at that. And so, yeah, I was just paying homage. If you want to look it up, anybody wants, it's Mr. Hulot's Holiday. Hulot is H-U-L-O-T. Mr. Hulot's Holiday. And that's Jacques Tati. Everything you need to know about Jacques Tati. As a matter of fact, years later, I ran into John Cleese. So he was on the show on Cheers. And but we spent a lot of time talking about Jacques Tati because Jacques Tati was an influence to John Cleese.
He was a mime, is an improvisational comedian, the whole works, right?
I wouldn't say he was a mime. I'd say he was unique.
Mm-hmm.
His outlook and how he moved was just hysterical. But it was a much slower time. You know, this is back in the 50s. He was making his films. And so you had to have a lot more patience. It wasn't like a guy coming out and snapping off of one line and then disappearing. You had to watch what was going on. But boy, was it funny.
I did have a question about your voice overwork, and you've done so many great characters in so many of these Pixar movies, and you're doing Inside Out 2. Do they give you a room to improvise in doing those characters? And, you know, you're in a sound booth and you're obviously doing the script that's in front of you. But talk about that process a little bit for people that may not understand it.
Well, I even started during Cheers. I think it took them 2 or 3 years to trust me enough to know that I wasn't going to try to, you know, hog the spotlight with improvising. That's a mistake a lot of people that, you know, call themselves improvisers make. It should be like a jazz band. You know, you play your part, but then shut up. let the saxophone player.
Right.
You know, everybody's. So that's that's the true art of improvisation. And you got to know when to keep quiet.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I really think it's wonderful how you came to be so successful, and all the success you had has been tremendous. And this foundation, very quickly, because I know you have to jump, Nuts, Bolts, and Thingamajigs, the foundation you created to fund manufacturing summer camps, scholarships nationwide, to get the trades going. I think that's important. My father put floors in for a living, and I wanted to be a carpenter when I was a kid, as I loved making anything out of wood. And I have my son do work around the house. We do drywalling together. And I think that's really important that, especially a lot of young people these days don't know how to work with their hands.
Yeah. We've got 300 camps nationwide, summer camps. We offer scholarships, and for more information on that, it's once again, the foundation's name is Nuts, Bolts, and Thingamajigs Foundation.
All right. Well, John, it's great to have you on. It's a great effort. Inside Out 2. Check it out. John Ratzenberger.
Hey, good luck out on the boat.
Thanks.
All right. There you go. That's John Ratzenberger. Really great interview. Great guy. Boy, you can hear Cliff Clavin in him whenever you talk to him. PaulMercurio.com to see my tour dates, Permission to Speak, my Broadway show directed by Frank Oz is out and about, and my stand-up July 12th at the Kennedy Center, of course, always in New York City, performing all the time where I'm based. And thanks for checking out the podcast. We'll see you guys next week.